On July 20th, 1969, the United States put a man on the moon. I'm Barrett Golding. You are hearing Voices, the best of public radio, and our destination is outer space, to the moon and beyond.
Well, I look at it myself as the beginning, really, of an exploration. That's the reason we're exploring. You don't know what you'll run into on an exploration. What the sky looks like, what the stars look like. Do they still twinkle, or are they a steady light when you get outside the atmosphere?
That's Exploration by the Karminsky Experience. In the early 1960s, the United States was losing the space race. The first satellite was the USSR Sputnik, 1957. The first human in space was Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin, April 1961. The month after that, President John F. Kennedy made a special address to the U.S. Congress.
Space is open to us now, and our eagerness to share its meaning is not governed by the efforts of others. We go into space because whatever mankind must undertake, free men must fully share. I therefore ask the Congress, above and beyond the increases I have earlier requested for space activities, to provide the funds which are needed to meet the following national goals. First, I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish. We propose to accelerate the development of the appropriate lunar spacecraft. We propose to develop alternate liquid and solid fuel boosters, much larger than any now being developed, until certain which is superior. We propose additional funds for other engine development and for unmanned exploration, explorations which are particularly important for one purpose which this nation will never overlook, the survival of the man who first makes this daring flight. But in a very real sense, it will not be one man going to the moon. We make this judgment affirmatively. It will be an entire nation, for all of us must work to put him there. Secondly, an additional $23 million, together with $7 million already available, will accelerate development of the Rover nuclear rocket. This gives promise of someday providing a means for even more exciting and ambitious exploration of space, perhaps beyond the moon, perhaps to the very end of the solar system itself.
What the sky looks like, what the sky looks like, what the sky looks like, what the stars look like, what the stars look like, what the stars look like, what the sky looks like, what the sky looks like, what the sky looks like, what the stars look like, what the stars look like.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
Roger, zero-G, and I feel fine. Capsule is turning around. Oh, that view is tremendous. Capsule turning around, and I could see the booster during turnaround just a couple of hundred yards behind me. It was beautiful.
Roger, 7, you have a go at least 7 orbits.
Roger, understand go for at least 7 orbits.
There's a lot of stuff floating around up here.
I'm in a big mass of some very small particles that are brilliantly lit up like they're luminescent.
Stand by. I think I see more. There was one, a random motion. Almost like a light snowflake particle caught in an eddy.
The sunset was beautiful. It went down very rapidly. I still have a brilliant blue band clear across the horizon, almost covering my whole window. The redness of the sunset I can still see through some of the clouds way over to the left of my course. The sky above is absolutely black, completely black. I can see stars, though, up above. I do not have any of the constellations identified as yet, over.
Transmission is coming to you approximately halfway between the moon and the Earth. We've been 31 hours, about 20 minutes into flight. We have about less than 40 hours left to go to the moon.
G is very comfortable, but after a while you get to the point where you sort of get tired of rattling around and banging off the ceiling and the floor and the side, so you intend to find a little corner somewhere and put your knees up or something like that to wedge yourself in, and that seems more at home.
Say again, please.
We got serious problems here with the engine. We're suffering end over end.
Voices from outer space. Those were transmissions from the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo missions. Music by Jeff Arnston of Racketship. And this is Biosphere with Third Planet.
I heard you cry out. Tell me, what did you encounter?
I had a dream about a man. He is not from our world.
He came down from the sky and spoke to me.
He said, we are from the third planet.
Go on, tell me.
He said, we come from Earth.
Which I've been playing for friends for more than 20 years now. I tend to play it to anybody who stops by the house. I've played it for the postman. I've played it for the plumber. I've had it for so long, I don't exactly recall how I got it. It would have had to have been back in the 70s, sometime when I was scuba diving a lot.
Commander Carpenter should be on in about 30 or 40 seconds.
At the time, I had friends, you know, scuba diving buddies, who were in the U.S. Navy. Apparently, it was making the rounds among U.S. Navy divers.
All right. Scott, we have a long-distance call for you. Will you hold, please?
Okay. The man you hear is Captain George Bond. In the mid-60s, Bond was in charge of a Navy program called SEALAB. The Navy was experimenting with sending divers to deeper and deeper depths for longer and longer periods of time to see what would happen, I guess. Now, one of these divers, the former astronaut Scott Carpenter, has just set a world record. He spent 30 days in the ocean at a depth of 200 feet. Captain Bond is now trying to place a prearranged phone call to the White House so that President Lyndon Johnson can offer Commander Carpenter the grateful thanks of the nation. It should be a purely ceremonial call, cut and dry. Commander Carpenter is not underwater anymore. He's in a decompression chamber. He's breathing air in which the nitrogen, which is the gas which can actually cause bends, the nitrogen has been replaced by helium. Helium's harmless, but it really messes up your voice. Listen now, as Bond and Carpenter try to convince a series of switchboard operators to please put the call through to the White House.
Operator, this is Commander Carpenter on the line.
Thank you. Hello,
Commander
Carpenter?
Scott?
Yes.
Can you hear me, operator?
Yes, we can.
Now, Scott, will you speak, please?
Yes, how do you hear me, operator?
Not too well, sir. Do you think it's possible to hear, or shall we try for a better connection? I don't know.
One, two, three, four, five, four, three, two, one. How do you hear that, operator?
I understand you. Yes.
But it's weak, I see.
Hello, operator. Yes. We can't hear him. Is this
operator.
The best you can do for a connection?
All right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. How now, operator?
Yes, we can understand you. Can you, ma'am? No. Well, he says that's the best he can do.
All right. I will assume that there's hardly any need to put the call through if,
operator, we wouldn't be able to understand. It's all garbled.
Well, bear in mind, operator, that my voice will sound quite different. I'm in a chamber with helium atmosphere, so the frequency of my voice is quite high.
Yes, it is.
That is not a telephone connection problem. That's just the result of my speaking from a pressurized chamber in a helium atmosphere. Do you understand?
Astronaut Cooper, are you able to understand me, over?
Yes, ma'am. This is Astronaut Carpenter, not Astronaut Cooper, however. Did you understand that?
I think the operator just can't understand your helium voice, but you sound very loud to me. And
when it comes to us, sir, it's very garbled, and we have to have a clear connection for the president.
Operator, this is helium speech. It will always be garbled, but I'm sure it will be understandable. The president knows that it is helium speech.
You think it's all right to put it through?
I would say it is all right. He understands that Commander Carpenter is in a synthetic gas atmosphere.
Operator?
Yes.
He said a synthetic what?
A synthetic helium gas.
Atmosphere.
Yes, and it makes his voice sound garbled and real high pitched.
Oh, I see. Okay, wait a minute. Now we'll try it.
Scott, I wonder if anybody understands this.
Well, I don't know. The operator said that she knew what I was trying to tell her, but apparently she didn't.
No. Well, we just sit tight and see.
All right.
At long last, President Johnson is going to appear on the line. You'll note that Johnson is not the least bit disturbed by Carpenter's voice.
Scott, do you read me all right?
Yes, sir, Mr. President. Read you loud and clear. How me?
Fine. Well, Scott, I'm mighty glad to hear from you. You've convinced me and all the nation that whether you're going up or down, you have the courage and the skill to do a fine job.
Well, thank you very much. There were a lot of other people who demonstrated the same kind of courage. It's a great crew out here, and we're all very honored and pleased that you saw fit to call us and let us know that you were interested in what we're doing.
I know that being 205 feet underwater for 30 days and making the excursion dives that you did has been very valuable to us and advanced our knowledge of how humans can perform under these conditions, and I want you to know that the nation's very proud of you. You're very brave and skillful, and I'm grateful that you've successfully completed this experiment.
Well, thank you very much, sir, on behalf of all the crew and all of those who participated in C-Lab. It's an honor to be a part of the program, and again, we're pleased to know that you're this interested in what we've been doing. I must apologize for the sound of my voice. It's the absolute best I can do in a helium atmosphere.
How are you feeling?
We're feeling very well. We entered the decompression chamber about 4 hours ago, and everyone is healthy, and we're running on schedule.
I've had a note from Ms. Carpenter, and your wife is very proud of you, as we all are, and I just wanted to say hello to you and all the fellows associated with you, and good luck, and we're mighty proud of you.
Thank you very much, sir, for calling.
Thank you, Scott. Good luck. I'll see you later.
Thank you.
As far as I know, this is the only phone call ever made from a decompression chamber to a president of the United States. It seems it was a noble experiment, but not one to be repeated.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Ignition sequence. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad.
Roger, Gino, looking great. You're about to go to all five engines.
Okay, babe, it's looking good. You're rolling your plate. We are pitching.
We're right over South America, and of course we can see up the Gulf Coast.
coast, and that looks like Houston's covered with clouds.
Hey, I just saw a flash on the lunar surface.
Just a pinprick of light.
Okay, I got the landing site. We're right over the top of it.
Bellinger, you're go for landing.
Oh, are we coming in? Oh, baby. Stand by for touchdown. 10 feet. That contact. Hey, Houston, the Challenger has landed.
Roger, Challenger, that's super.
Houston, you can tell America that Challenger is a Taurus Littoral. We'd like to dedicate the first step of Apollo 17 to all those who made it possible. I come out here, oh my golly, unbelievable. Just walk around for 1 second.
I was rolling on the moon one day in a merry, merry month of December.
Now, May.
May's the month.
Hey, there is orange soil. It's all over. Hey, it is. I can see it from here. It's orange.
Apollo 17 astronauts Ronald Evans, Eugene Cernan, and Harrison Smith, the last men on the moon. They left December 1972. No one's been back since. This music is by Jeff Arnson. And that tape of LBJ with helium-filled astronaut Scott Carpenter came to us from Larry Massett and Lost and Found Sound. Coming up, more from outer space on Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
This week on Hearing Voices, we're in outer space. So it's only right we hear some space music.
Maximum distance from the sun, 94,537,000 miles. Minimum distance from the sun, 91,377,000 miles. Mean distance from the sun, 92,957,200 miles. Mean orbital velocity, 66,000 miles per hour. Orbital eccentricity, 0.017. Obliquity of the ecliptic, 23 degrees, 27 minutes, 8.26 seconds.
Some facts about Mother Earth from Vangelis, the title track of his Albedo 0.39. Albedo is a measure of a planet's brightness.
Length of the tropical year, equinox to equinox, 365.24 days. Length of the sidereal year, fixed star to fixed star, 365.26 days. Length of the mean solar day, 24 hours, 3 minutes, 56.555 seconds in mean solar time. length of the mean sidereal day. 23 hours, 56 minutes, 4.091 seconds in mean solar time. Mass, 6,600 million 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 tons. Equatorial diameter, 7,927 miles. Polar diameter, 7,900 miles. Oblateness, 1/298. Density, 5.41. Mean surface gravitational acceleration of the rotating Earth, 32.174 feet per second per second. Escape velocity, 7 miles per second.
It was the night flight from Houston. Almost perfect visibility. You could see the lights from all the little Texas towns far below. And I was sitting next to a 52-year-old woman who had never been on a plane before. And her son had sent her a ticket and said, "Mom, you've raised 10 kids. It's time you got on a plane." She was sitting in the window seat, staring out, and she kept talking about the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper and pointing. And suddenly, I realized that she thought we were in outer space, looking down at the stars. And I said, "You know, I think those lights down there are the lights from little towns."
You heard Laurie Anderson, Night Flight to Houston, and this is some real space music. Radio emissions from Saturn captured by the Cassini spacecraft. Apollo 11 astronaut Buzz Aldrin, the second man on the moon, put out a rap song. The sales benefit his Share Space Foundation, which he says shares the wonders of space with children of all ages.
Buzz, this is Houston. We've got about 10 minutes left now.
10 minutes left now prior to commencing your EVA termination activities. Over.
All you need is the rocket experience. What you need is the rocket experience. All you need is the rocket experience.
To go flying into outer space.
If you head over to the website funnyordie.com, you'll see a mockumentary on the making of the rocket experience. Buzz talks with the musicians who helped him out, Snoop Dogg, Quincy Jones, and Talib Kweli.
All you need is the rocket experience.
That's what I'm talking about.
That's hot right there, man.
Buzz Aldrin got his bars up. You know what I'm saying? You see, he made up a dance and all
he
that.
He did that. All you need is a rocket experience. That was geisty.
I have only two passions, space exploration and hip-hop.
People in the rap game, we've known about Buzz for years. The group Black Star. People think we named it after Marcus Garvey and the whole Black Star line. Nah, it's named after Buzz, Dr. Rendezvous, because you know he had those orbital rendezvous techniques he developed at MIT.
You know, the person that had the biggest inspiration on my own, everything I do as far as music and production and just everything, it has to be Buzz Aldrin, the best that ever did it.
I saw the first moonwalk, and when we saw the guys get off that spaceship, you know, the lack of gravity and everything else, and all the other ones were cool, but the one, Buzz, my man Buzz, you know, the brother had a great groove going on. You know, he had his little step going, and he was so cool.
The song, Whitey on the Moon, Gil Scott-Heron, what you thought he was talking about, LBJ and Nixon? No, he was talking about Buzz Aldrin.
I can't pay no doctor bills, but Whitey's on the moon.
Gil and I are cool now. I explained to him that we came in peace for all mankind, and he backed off.
People think of hip-hop, and they think of beefs. We had East Coast, West Coast beef, down south, up top beefs, but it doesn't compare to the beef between earthwalkers and moonwalkers, which I think is a way more dangerous beef.
I don't have any beef with the earthwalkers.
We was posted up at my pad playing a little video game, Fight Night 4. And Buzz leaned over and was like, yo, Snoop, I'm thinking about doing this record to commemorate my 40th year anniversary walking on the moon.
Say, you know, Snoop, you got to do a little more work on your left jab there, too.
I will do that.
I was shocked when Buzz hit me on Twitter and was like, yo, I'm working on this album. But, you know, he wanted to get more of like an underground feel, so he had to bring me in. You know, I had to do my thing on the record.
Well, it sure is fun twittering with you.
Oh, yeah, you know, I'm the Twitter king. You know?
All you need is the rocket experience.
Yo, man, I think we need to tone the beat down just a little bit because we're going to lose the message. It's too hard. What you need is a rocket experience. So when you're saying it, visualize yourself performing it. Put a little bit more attitude in it.
Going up in a rocket.
Exactly, yeah. Like if you was flying in space.
Yeah. All you need is the rocket experience. All you need is the rocket experience.
All you need is a rocket experience. All you need is a rocket experience. All you need is a rocket experience. There it is. Take that.
I think I got you. Y'all
got
to read this book, man. Buzz Aldrin is so gangster.
Now, Buzz, you need a remix of the song. And I got you. I'm going to do a G-Mix style. From the ground to the fly, to the high, to the sky, to the clouds, to the stars, to Mars. The stars can see it's me, D-O-double-G. To the moon, consume, let the bass go boom. We could fly in a rocket, got the smoke in a socket. You could put it in your pocket, unlock it. I'm a rocket, it's Snoop, D-O-dub, with Buzz. That's my cuz, I'ma show you what it is. Now you know what it was. It's the G-Mix, fly me to space.
I've been there, now I say it's your turn. All we gotta do is make the engine burn. Let's take a trip on an orbital spaceship. This is how we will reach the stars.
Make sure that you've got your feet underneath you. Lack of gravity. Gravity.
All you need is the rocket experience.
Beautiful view, magnificent desolation.
What you need is the rocket experience.
Buzz, you're clear to take off.
All you need is the rocket experience.
Roger, understand. We're number one on the runway.
All you need is the rocket experience. It's all you need.
To go flying into outer space.
I am the spaceman.
To see this world as a beautiful place.
I am the rocket man.
All mankind, one human race.
It's time to venture far. Let's take a trip to Mars. Our destiny is to the stars. All you need is the rocket experience.
Scientists from all over the world have been debating the status of one of the planets in our solar system. Is it a planet? Is it not a planet? You Earthlings, you listen to the scientific facts laid out in the sun. You decide for yourself. Is it a planet? Or is it a planet? In Arizona, at the turn of the 20th century, astro-mathematician Percival Lowell was searching for what he called Planet X, because he knew deep down in his soul that an unseen gravitational presence meant a new planet spinning in the air, joining the other eight already known, circling our sun up there. But Percival Lowell died in 1916, his theory still only a theory. Till 1930, when Clyde Tombaugh, in his scientific query, discovered Planet X, 3.7 billion miles from our sun. A smallish ball of frozen rock, methane and nitrogen. It joined Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Our solar system's newest neighbor, two-thirds the size of our moon. A tiny, barely visible speck of coal, minus 440 below. Not exactly paradise. They named the planet
Pluto!
Right! Phew, you're paying attention. That same year, 1930, Walt Disney debuted his own Pluto as well. But a cartoon dog with the very same name as the CEO of hell. Now that was not your normal Disney style. Most thought he was riding the coattails of Plutomania sweeping the land, not unlike our modern love for manatees and whales. For the next 5 decades, mysterious Pluto captivated our minds. As late as 1978, its on Mon Caron was seen for the very first time. But now, telescopes and satellites and computer calculations say that Pluto may not be a planet at all, creating great consternation. Some scientists say that Pluto is a trans-Neptunian interloper swept away by an unknown force, or a remnant of a wayward comet somehow sucked off course. Others say that Pluto is an asteroid in the sun's gravitational pull. But if you had asked Clyde Tombaugh, he would have told you that's all bull. I get hundreds of letters from kids every year. He says, is Pluto the planet they love? It's not Pluto the comet, it's not Pluto the asteroid they wonder about above. And that the International Astronomical Union Working Group for Planetary System Nomenclature, that is a real club. They too say Pluto is a planet, reinforcing Clyde Tombaugh's view of nature. Norwegian Carrie Eksnes, professor at the Theoretical Astrophysics Institute, he too says Pluto is a planet and a significant one to boot. But at the University of Colorado, astronomer Larry Esposito, don't applaud this man.
He says if Pluto were discovered today, it would not be a planet. End of discussion, finito. He says that Pluto is definitely not spun off from solar matter like the other eight planets we know. By every scientific measurement we have, is Pluto a planet? No. And now 20 astronomy textbooks refer to Pluto as less than a planet. I guess if Pluto showed up at a planet convention, the bouncer would be forced to ban it. St. Christopher's looking down on this, and he says, Pluto, I can relate. When I was Demona from sainthood, I gotta tell you, little buddy, it didn't feel real great. And Scorpios look up in despair, because Pluto rules their sign. Is now reading their daily horoscope just a futile waste of time? It takes 248 Earth years for Pluto to circle our sun. It's tiny and it's cold, but of all heavenly bodies, it was Clyde Tombaugh's favorite one. Till he was 91, he worked every day in Las Cruces, New Mexico, determined to maintain the planetary status of his beloved Pluto. But how are we going to deal with it if science comes up with the proof that Pluto is never a planet? How do we handle this truth as the PhDs all disagree? We don't know yet who's wrong or who's right. But wherever you are and whatever you are, Pluto, we know you're up there tonight. And in the year 2016, you're going to see the New Horizons Express fly by and take pictures of your way cool surface to send to your webpage address. http://doxxx.colorado.edu/plutohome.html. You've got your own webpage for little guy. You sure made quite a splash. Yes, at the turn of the 20th century, astro-mathematician Percy Lowell, in his quest for Planet X, started this ball to roll. But at the start of the 21st century, we think he may have been a little off base. So we look at the sky and wonder what new surprises await us in outer space. We look at the sky and we wonder.
Christine Lavin recorded live her song Planet X. These sounds were sent back by Voyager 2 as it flew by the planet Uranus. The northern lights are caused by particles from the sun hitting Earth's magnetic field. Those same solar particles produce a natural radio, electromagnetic waves which you can hear if you have the right equipment. And recordist Steve McGreevy's got a van full. Whenever he can, he heads north and away from towns. That's where the listening is best. A while ago, I caught up with him in Canada at the Belly River Campground in southern Alberta's Waterton Park.
There's just a whole litany of different natural radio sounds to record. Hisslers and growlers and howlers and tweaks. These clusters like a pack of dogs barking. And in the case of this morning, we're having these very soft, hissy whistlers, which are actually fairly rare.
It's 5:24 in the morning on Monday, the 22nd of June, 1998, at Waterton Park, Belly River Campground, southern Alberta, Canada. And he's got these great hissy whistlers happening, and in the right channel we're hearing the beginnings of chorus.
There was a burst of static from something pretty close, a lightning storm. Oftentimes when I'm recording, you'll hear kind of a and maybe a second or two later you'll hear the electromagnetic pulse from the lightning bolt takes a round trip to the opposite hemisphere, and then it bounces back. And in making this long trip, the frequency components are spread out, so you get this downward falling tone, like a sigh or a hiss. These receivers are sensitive enough that a lightning storm could be happening 1,000 miles away and the static would still be strong. You can just hear all the snapping. Let me turn on this speaker amplifier. You just can imagine there is so much. Oh, in fact, we're hearing some nice noises now coming in. Okay, this is a very beautiful sounding event. This is called chorus. Particles from the sun are hitting Earth's magnetic field and generating these noises, probably several thousand miles out in space. Imagine a soap bubble with wind currents pushing against it, and you can see it deform. Well, that's essentially what happens with Earth's magnetic field. So yeah, I've got these funky-looking triangular-shaped loops, five turns of about 350 feet of wire hanging up on the tree, picking up the beautiful sounds of Mother Earth. They're just vibrations of electrical and magnetic energy. And so essentially all these receivers do is pick up the Earth's radio waves and translate them directly to the same sound frequencies. And so the result is just beautiful and amazing. And it's been going on, well, for eons. And they first noticed it in England in about 1882. The British telegraph operators started hearing these strange whistling tones in their headphones. But it wasn't until the 1930s when some people started associating these with visible northern lights. As electronic equipment became more available to the average experimenter and hobbyist, amateurs started listening to this using fairly crude equipment, you know, maybe a phonograph amplifier connected to a barbed wire fence in the middle of nowhere, and similar to what I did when I first heard this myself. When I discovered Earth makes its own radio waves, I was amazed because I'm a nature enthusiast anyway, and always been interested in astronomy and science. I've got a long, quite checkered history with radio, beginning as a little kid playing with an AM pocket radio and tuning in distant stations at night, and I've done all sorts of crazy things, planting radio beacons in the middle of the deserts and bouncing signals off aircraft. And I was a pirate radio operator for 8 years. One Sunday evening, I got a knock on the door about 10:30 at night. The fellow said, "Hi, I'm from the FCC. May I see your station?" Just about as cheerful as can be. There's a station in Colorado called WWV, which does nothing but transmit the time, 24 hours a day, on shortwave.
Polish Russell indices for 21 June follow. Solar flux 102 and bold A index 16. Repeat solar flux.
But once an hour, WWV gives lets me know what's going on with the Earth's magnetic field, and they give what they call space weather, which is what's going on in the sun and between the sun and the Earth.
Solar activity was low. The geomagnetic field was quiet to minor storm. The forecast
so
the next 24
hours. I'm aware that right now the Earth is in a magnetic storm, and it may be affecting power lines right now. It may be affecting satellites right now. Space weather, this invisible weather we can't really see or feel on Earth, but indeed it's going on out there. And it's wild, and it's stormy at times, and it's calm at other times. It's just like weather here on Earth. Well, at this very moment, I've got my headphones on. These whistlers are really coming in big streams now. There's just one whistler kind of merging into the other, all slowly descending in pitch. Oh, these are so great. Wow.
Steve McGreevy and the Sounds of Natural Radio, produced for LostAndFoundSound.com. I'm Barrett Golding. Links to all our otherworldly sounds are found at HearingVoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of SoundImagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.